From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is War News Radio.
I'm Danny Noble.
And I'm Cyrus Stoller.
There are so many poor children in Iraq. There's so much misery. There are so many poor slums. Do you think these children will read? Do you think they'll open a book? The kids are in a cage. They're choked.
This week on War News Radio, Growing Up, we take a look at issues concerning young people in Iraq and Afghanistan, from education to entertainment. First, we learn about Scholastic International's initiative to deliver American children's books to Iraqi libraries.
Then, a program that brings wounded Iraqi children to the United States for medical care.
We also hear two Afghan teenagers describe their experiences growing up under the Taliban and the new challenges they face as college students in America.
Plus... An Iraqi cartoon program educating children about the dangers of living in a war zone.
Finally, we hear about the status of schools in Afghanistan through the eyes of an American elementary school teacher working there.
This is War News Radio. In 2004, Scholastic International Vice President Carol Sakoyan created My Arabic Library, a program that ships children's books to countries in the Arab world. Funded by the State Department's Middle East Partnership Initiative, My Arabic Library has translated books like The Magic School Bus and Heidi into Arabic and sent them to Lebanon, Jordan, Bahrain, Morocco, and Iraq. In a report filed in November, Anna Sheckman describes how the program is being received in Iraqi classrooms and within the Iraqi government.
My Arabic Library creator Carol Sakoyan says that children need two kinds of books, those that reflect their own reality and those that broaden their horizon to the world beyond their own. The books that Sakoyan's program sends to Iraq fall into that second category and engage kids in a global community. Sakoyan explains.
One of Scholastic's mission is to help create global citizens, just as we've been doing since 1920 in the United States. And we try to convey in these books all the positive values that people around the world share.
Choosing books that would be acceptable in predominantly Muslim nations was no easy task. Teachers and ministry representatives from a few Middle Eastern nations sorted through Scholastic books and picked those that they felt were appropriate and interesting.
We try to be culturally sensitive in everything that we do. And one of the things we did was we made some modifications of the clothes. We lengthened some sleeves. We lengthened some skirts. You know, we were sensible that way because in public schools, these were going into government schools. They're particularly conservative. One series that was not acceptable is Clifford the Big Red Dog, because in Muslim countries there is concern about dogs and the fact that they're not clean, so they don't want the children to have those images.
After early success stories from other Middle Eastern nations, Scholastic brought My Arabic Library to Iraq, where the need for children's books has been exacerbated by the war. Iraq's Minister of Education, Dr. Qudair Al-Kuzai, describes the condition of Iraqi libraries.
We have very few school libraries. We inherited ruins that we are trying to rebuild all over again. Last year, we started to buy some books and distribute them to the schools. But these are not libraries. These are only the nucleus. God willing, we will develop them in the future.
Azhar Al-Sharbaf, a lawyer and the head of the social and legal clinic in Baghdad, attributes the lack of children's books to a broader decay of children's culture in Iraq.
In general, culture in Iraq has declined. I remember when we were children, in my generation, I was reading when I was in fifth grade. When I was in seventh grade, I was reading Chekhov. This culture doesn't exist anymore.
Al-Sharbaf's son, Hamoudi, a fifth grader, proves his mother's point. He says, I don't know what to tell you, but I have never read a storybook, not even one story. I only read my school books. Al-Sharbaf attributes this cultural decline to Iraq's rampant poverty and corrupt government.
There are so many poor children in Iraq. There's so much misery. There are so many poor slums. Do you think these children will read? Do you think they'll open a book? The kids are in a cage. They're choked. The government's culture is that of political parties and powerful groups and the cousin of this official and the relative of that official. Do you think these people are interested in developing a culture? Do you think they're creative? No, there's nothing like that.
The Iraqi government did purchase books from My Arabic Library, 650,000 of them, but Al-Sharbaf is skeptical that they will ever reach Iraqi children.
The people who are in charge of education are ignorant people. Do you actually believe that the Ministry of Education will distribute Scholastic books in schools? They'll probably receive them and store them somewhere.
Her fears may not be misguided. Although Iraq's Minister of Education reviewed Scholastic's books before buying them, he's still concerned about their Western content.
I've seen some of those books, and they do not meet the Arabic, Iraqi, and Islamic taste. There's a huge gap between our culture as Iraqis in the East and the cultures in the West. Whoever tries to reflect the Western culture in the Arab-Iraqi society, I think they'll bump into a big rock and they will never be able to penetrate it. If they want to help, they should not be marketing their culture through a cultural invasion, because they will only face closed doors. If someone wants to market a culture that does not meet ours, he would be planting a palm tree in the North Pole. It would die fast.
Sequoyan of Scholastic rejects that claim that the books of my Arabic library amount to a cultural invasion. In fact, she says that many of the books are not American.
They're international information for children. There are books that come from Africa, there are books that come from India, there are books that come from Europe. It's not American at all. And the books on penguins and spiders and volcanoes, we don't consider those American books.
Despite Scholastic's extensive vetting process, Sequoyan concedes that some of the books could be controversial, especially those with strong female characters that bend traditional gender roles.
There are a lot of female heroines in these books. Amelia Earhart, Marie Curie. And the boys love these stories. In fact, in the Amelia Earhart story, they didn't seem to make the difference that this was a woman. And so we're just delighted that these girls empowering stories are going all over.
My Arabic library has undoubted obstacles to overcome. In Iraq, providing children with storybooks is not a governmental priority. But what does that mean for Hamoudi, Al-Sherbaf's son who never reads for pleasure? And what does that mean for Iraq's future? For War News Radio, I'm Anna Shekman.
This is War News Radio. Critics of the war in Iraq often point to the thousands of civilian casualties that have occurred since 2003, many directly caused by American military action. But one man is turning criticism into action. In May, Peter Holmes spoke with the founder of No More Victims, an organization attempting to secure medical care for the youngest victims of violence in Iraq.
Every day, the news from Iraq brings numbers. Numbers of attacks, numbers of casualties, numbers of dead. Ever wonder what it's like to be one of those numbers? Cole Miller has.
Imagine if you came home one day and you found that your home had been bombed and that two of your children had been killed and that another child had had a limb blown off and you rush that child to a clinic and there's no painkiller. There's no clean water. Those are the kinds of events that the Iraqi people are having to live with every day and have had to live with for years.
Hearing stories like this prompted Cole Miller to found No More Victims. It's a grassroots organization that helps treat children injured in the war in Iraq. Miller, an activist from California who frequently travels to the Middle East, gets Iraqi doctors and aid workers to identify children who might benefit from treatment in the United States. Then he gets Americans involved to arrange medical care for the children, housing for the families.
I just want to give communities the opportunity to help an individual child. Because that child's story speaks for the stories of thousands and thousands of other children in Iraq who are suffering from the same injuries and have the same needs.
With so much bloodshed in Iraq, so many children needing specialized medical treatment abroad, how does No More Victims decide who to help? The most important criterion, says Miller, is who will benefit most. But there's another ethical consideration.
Then I work with children whose injuries resulted directly from U.S. military assault because I think that's where my first responsibility lies. As a taxpayer here, I'm helping to fund the operations that are hurting children. So I feel as though those are the children that I should focus on.
Cole Miller's No More Victims is a small organization. So far, he has helped to bring just 5 Iraqi children here. But each story has an impact, like the story of Abdul Hakim, a young Iraqi boy who was injured in the April 2004 United States assault on Fallujah.
At about 11 o'clock at night, his home was hit by a mortar round. He was in bed asleep at the time it occurred, and he was burned on one side of his face. His left temporomandibular joint was crushed. He lost some teeth, and he had a lot of scarring on his cheek, and he also lost his left eye.
To get treatment for Abdul here in the States, Miller contacted Dan Kovalik, a lawyer in Pittsburgh. With other volunteers, Kovalik arranged for plastic surgeons to perform reconstructive surgery, pro bono. No More Victims secured visas for Abdul and his father and brought them to the city, where in the spring of 2006, Abdul underwent surgery to repair his jaw and face and received a prosthetic eye. Kovalik says the community rallied around Abdul, a sweet, outgoing child who rapidly won their hearts.
In Pittsburgh, he became kind of a celebrity. I mean, we'd go out together and people'd shake his hand. And we were at the amusement park once, and there were these kids walking by, and they saw him, and they recognized him, and they gave him the toys they had won at the amusement park. I mean, that sort of thing just happened all the time.
Ala Khalid is another one of the five Iraqi children brought to America for treatment. A three-year-old Iraqi girl, Ala was injured when a U.S. tank round slammed into her house early in the afternoon. Ashley Severance, a law student living near Orlando, Florida, who arranged Ala's care there, describes what happened.
Her two brothers that were closest to it died, and they were real young, like around the ages of five. And Ala was the closest one to the explosions, and they didn't think she was going to survive, and her body was just peppered in shrapnel, and she had some serious stomach wounds, and I guess it's kind of comparable to like a double hernia, and she had lost her vision in both eyes.
In November of 2005, doctors at Arnold Palmer Hospital in Florida removed the shrapnel from Ala's eyes and reattached her retinas, restoring her eyesight. Ala was then transported to Orange County Children's Hospital in California, where surgeons repaired her abdominal hernia and removed further shrapnel. For Ashley Severance, the first priority was always Ala and her treatment. But like Cole Miller, Severance too wants to send a message to the American people.
You hear, you know, oh, Iraqi insurgents and jihadists and this and that, and we don't put a face with it. And I wanted people to see Ala's face because she just was the sweetest little thing and to me portrayed innocence. And I just wanted people to see, you know, what's on the other end. I don't think any one of us would say, hey, let's go bomb a three-year-old. You know, we may have different political views, but I don't think anybody would say, you know, hey, let's just go, you know, kill this family.
Severance and Cole Miller, founder of No More Victims, know that they can never help all of the injured children. But they also know that they must do something.
We are, at the end of the day, responsible for what's happening. And the rest of the world is going to judge us as citizens, as Americans, as people. They're going to judge us based on what we're doing, not our professions of benign intent, not our protestations that we wear the white hats. They see what we're doing, and that's the basis on which they're going to judge us.
No More Victims gives Cole Miller a way to respond to the war. His organization gives other Americans the same chance. But no matter how many minds they change, they know they've changed lives.
So a 22-year-old law student from Orlando, Florida, saved that little girl's eyesight. Now, that little girl will be able to see her own children in the future. There are countless children who are in similar situations who will not get the care, who will go blind. So in this instance, one child who was going to be destined to a life of blindness is not going to be blind.
If this way of responding to the Iraqi war sparks your interest, you can reach No More Victims through their website. There's a link on ours, warnewsradio.org. For War News Radio, I'm Peter Holm.
This is War News Radio. Students in America know that nothing is certain but death and taxes, and homework. Under the Taliban, however, education in Afghanistan was either unavailable or dramatically altered. In September 2006, Jess Engebretson spoke with two Afghan teenagers now studying at American colleges. They shared their experiences growing up under the Taliban, their memories of 9/11, and their thoughts on adjusting to their new college lives.
Syed Jawed Sarchazma might look like an average Skidmore College freshman, but he's not exactly going home for Thanksgiving.
and I live in Kabul, Afghanistan. I have five sisters, and I have no brother. I'm the only brother. And I was 13 years old that my mom was killed during the regime of the Taliban.
Syed's life as an orphan under the Taliban led him to flee with his sisters into neighboring Pakistan. They returned to Kabul 2 years later and faced an increasingly difficult life. His sisters, who were running the family, couldn't find work. Across the country in Kandahar, Syed's future high school classmate, Roya Mohammadi, now a freshman at Smith College, also struggled with the restrictive policies the Taliban imposed on women.
I was not able to go to school. I was not able to go outside alone. And there was not any activities like sport or anything to do. This is what I hate from that time.
Both Roya and Syed refused to let the Taliban run their lives and decided to break the law. Roya chose to go to school despite the Taliban's restrictions on education, while Syed took his political education into his own hands by starting a discussion group with his classmates.
We had a group.
I used to go to school as well. It was underground, run by a woman. She came from Pakistan, but she was an Afghan woman.
As Americans, going to school and talking politics with our friends are not exactly life-threatening activities, but Afghan students risked severe consequences, like imprisonment.
And we got caught. We got into prison during Taliban. That was, oh my God.
And that was really scary for me and for my family.
That was your life. You know, you always thought of that. Okay, one day I'm going to prison or one day I'm dying. But we passed it. Actually, I learned a lot from it. I learned from every moment of it.
For Americans, September 11th brings back vivid memories. Even in Afghanistan, with limited access to foreign news, Roya and Syed were aware of that day's events. But for them, the subsequent U.S. invasion had a more direct impact. With the Taliban gone, life became easier for young people. Syed was able to speak his mind freely in class and got an interesting job working as a translator with the U.S. troops.
Very dangerous places. Every minute you're dying, every second you're just waiting for a bullet to come and hit you because it was terribly, dreadfully scary. Oh my God. But at the same time, it was fun. I was working as a translator. Yeah, at the same time as a guide, but it was tough. Oh my God.
For the first time in years, Roya could socialize with people her own age. She went back to school and got a job where she met her fiancé. Both Roya and Syed decided to further their education in the U.S., eventually ending up at Arm & Hammer United World College in New Mexico, where they finally met. Naturally, it was a big adjustment. Now in college, and having survived 2 years in the United States, they're facing many of the same problems most American students deal with during their freshman year.
And I have to work out by my own. I have to find what classes I want to study. And I have to make decisions. I have to do whatever I want to do. Here, I have to help myself.
I'm taking government class. Because I want to do my major in politics. I'm always fighting in the class.
I'm taking Arabic. That is also the main question people just ask me. Do you know Arabic? Most people think that whoever came from Afghanistan, they can speak Arabic.
And I'm taking business and management. I'm taking English writing, academic writing, because I need it. I'm stuck in writing.
Though their journeys to the U.S. are extraordinary, these two are just normal college freshmen. They miss home, they complain about work, and they're getting to know a new place. Both eventually want to return to their country and help rebuild. Until then, they're enjoying their time in America. One thing they'd change? Make the visa process easier so that their friends can come to the U.S. too. For War News Radio, I'm Jess Engebretson.
This is War News Radio. There aren't enough teachers in Afghanistan. Many are too scared to teach, especially when they see their colleagues fall victim to violent groups like the Taliban. And most of the few still teaching have little formal education. In September 2007, my co-host, Cyrus Stoller, reported on an American teacher hoping to use her skills in the classroom to change Afghan education for the better.
Marianne O'Grady expected things to be different in Afghanistan. but she never thought that she would be mistaken for a CIA agent. O'Grady is an elementary school teacher who has been to Afghanistan 9 times with the Afghan Friends Network, a group based in San Francisco that trains Afghan teachers.
We were going to classify fingerprints. Hey, well and good. It's a great activity. I've done it with hundreds and hundreds of teachers. These teachers were not going to do it. And they, like, crossed their arms and they said, nope, we're not going to do this. You probably work for the CIA or something. And I hadn't even thought about that. It was like a cultural thing that I just, you know, shoved my foot, my leg, down my throat.
O'Grady managed to solve the misunderstanding and later found out that the Afghan teachers were eager to learn as much as they could. Though many of them had been teachers their entire adult lives, O'Grady's teaching methods were new to them.
They could not get the magnifying glass to work. They kept saying, teacher, no work. And, you know, a magnifying glass is about, you know, 2 inches around. It's just a piece of curved glass. And they didn't know how to focus it. They've never used a hand lens, never mind a microscope, in their whole lives. And then they've been biology teachers for 30 years.
After the fall of the Taliban in 2001, many Afghan students have had a chance to go to school. But the educational infrastructure still has a long way to go. Most students go to school for only 3 hours a day because there are not enough classrooms or teachers for them. So different groups of students have to use the same buildings in shifts throughout the day. Some have classes in tents, or even under trees, for as few as 15 minutes. Due to the lack of teachers, up to 100 students have to crowd into a classroom to hear one teacher. 17-year-old Ayub Zazai attends Habibia High School in Kabul, where he studies with over 20,000 other students. At his school, Zazai says conditions are far from ideal.
We don't have any computer lab. No one knows what's computer, how to do anything in computer.
Zazai blames the lack of resources for his boredom in school and feels that he isn't really learning much. According to O'Grady, these resources supposedly exist, but they aren't in the hands of the students.
Lots of people have donated a lot of money, and they're supposedly been printed in Iran and all this other kind of stuff. And every time we go there, we just hear more about how hard it is for teachers to even themselves get a set of the textbooks without having to purchase them. Everyone ends up just buying them on the black market.
It seems that the lack of resources and space is not the only problem in Afghan schools. Finding enough teachers for the huge number of students has proved to be the big challenge.
We do not have nice professional teachers in English language. Anyone who speaks well English, they are doing their work in they're working with Americans in big companies.
Many of those who do teach claim they don't have teaching materials. O'Grady believes that they need to think a little more outside the box, but in the meantime is providing them with donated materials.
What do you mean you don't have the materials? I just bought these in the bazaar 2 hours ago down the street. They're from your market. We don't have any money. And that I actually can absolutely relate to as an educator and knowing, you know, how little they make and that sort of thing. I mean, I'm giving you a set, though, when we leave of all of the materials here so that you can do these with your students. So you will be able to do this, maybe not always. Oh, we can't do it. I teach under a tree, you know, and it's not dark enough. It's, you know, we have barely any shade. I mean, they're making 1,000,005 excuses. You know, but usually then after a few days of resistance, somebody will come up and say something about how they thought this was really interesting.
Despite these shortcomings, Zazai continues to dream big. He wants to become an engineer, and he hopes he can fulfill that dream somewhere outside Afghanistan. For War News Radio, I'm Cyrus Stoller. This is War News Radio. Iraqi children are able to watch a wide variety of television programs, thanks to the arrival of satellite TV. One of those programs is a cartoon series produced by a young Iraqi animator who now lives in Jordan. His most recent work, Jossam Show, focuses on the challenges that Iraqi children face in their daily lives. Ben Mendelsohn has more in this report, originally aired in March 2008.
Hassam Abdesaheb is a 31-year-old Iraqi cartoonist from Baghdad. He studied computer science at Baghdad University and has been producing television cartoons for the past several years. Most of his works are shown on a Middle Eastern satellite channel called Spacetoon.
Garcia. Garcia.
Help me, Chini.
We saw the choice, Sadiq, Chini.
During Saddam Hussein's regime, satellite television was banned. But in 2004, 1 year after the fall of the regime, Hassam was able to start working for Spacetoon. Before long, he was targeted by gunmen at his Baghdad office. The gunmen destroyed Hassam's equipment, and he fled the country to Jordan. There, he produces educational cartoons in Arabic for Iraqi children.
In Iraq, we cooperate with some non-governmental organizations to develop a media campaign, helping them when they have campaigned about hygiene or mine risk education.
Spacetoon doesn't just work with Iraqi NGOs. Organizations such as UNICEF and UNESCO also occasionally launch educational programs for children. These organizations identify the problems facing children in war zones, and Hassam turns those issues into cartoons that can better appeal to kids.
Sometimes the children, they don't know what kind of this dangerous around them. So they go to a minefield for playing or for farming like this, and they have this accident.
Creating cartoons that send the right message about dangers like mines can be trickier than it looks. Hassam says that one cartoon in the former Yugoslavia unintentionally sent a very dangerous message, and he says he does not want to make that mistake in Iraq.
The children, they like Superman too much. So when the children saw in the cartoon that there is a child went to the minefield and Superman come and help this child, you know. So the children, when they take this message, they start to go to the minefield waiting for Superman. Because of that, we must be careful when we transferring the educational message to cartoon.
Hassam is not alone in his work. It's a group effort. A number of professional experts like doctors, psychologists, and teachers work together to write and edit the script for every cartoon they produce. Around 40% of the Iraqi population is under the age of 18, and Hassam says that the children of his country face enormous problems these days. He says he's willing to go back to Baghdad to continue his work addressing those problems, but he thinks the Iraqi government should also take some responsibility toward the children of Iraq.
Iraqi children now, they are facing a very serious problem. No one can explain for the children what's happening now or what's the meaning of democracy or that, or telling them there will be a good future for you.
In the meantime, Hassam hopes that the Iraqi government will focus on working toward those goals. For War News Radio, I'm Ben Mendelsohn.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
On our site, you can also comment on this show or on our past programs.
Our behind-the-scenes crew includes Emily Hager, Jess Engebretson, Calvin Ho,
Hanzi Lo Wang, Marge Murphy, and Abdullah Maziad. I'm Danny Noble.
And I'm Cyrus Stoller. Until next time, thanks for listening.